This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last year, forest fires killed 23 firefighters, destroyed more than 800 homes and other structures, burned nearly 7 million acres, and cost $1.5 billion to fight. It was the worst fire season in more than 50 years. This year, forecasters expect, could be almost as bad. Right now, 5 fires are burning out west, 2 in Arizona, 1 in New Mexico, 1 in Utah, and 1 in Hawaii, none yet as intense or as large as last year's big fires. What will be done this year to fight and contain wildfires? What can be done to prevent them in the first place, and will a change of policy make a difference? Later in our program, a reviewer and an historian of First Ladies join us to talk about Senator Clinton's new book, but first, forests and fires. If you've ever lived through a wildfire as a firefighter or as a homeowner, call and tell us what it was like if you live near the woods in the red zone, the wildland-urban interface. What are you doing to protect your home? And if you venture into wildlands, have you seen any areas prone to fires or recovering from one? Give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from her office here in Washington is Rebecca Watson, Assistant Secretary for Land and Mineral Management in the Department of the Interior, who's the administration's point person on the Healthy Forest Initiative, and good to have you with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. I'm glad to be here.
Can you tell us what's in the Healthy Forest Initiative?
Yes, the Healthy Forest Initiative really came from the grassroots to the White House, and it was something that really resonated with President Bush, and he challenged the U.S. Forest Service at the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Interior with its 4 bureaus to look at their processes and see how we might better address the dense, unhealthy condition of federal forests, woodlands, and rangelands. So over the last months, we have come up with administrative tools that we will implement to improve the amount of work that we can get done to prevent forest fires and rangeland fires.
Now, where does this proposal stand?
Right now, we've come out with 2 guidance documents at the end of last year addressing Endangered Species Act processing and how to do it better and smarter. We have a proposed ESA rule that's out for public comment right now. We have issued a final version of improved National Environmental Policy Act process, categorical exclusion. And we also have 15 model environmental assessment projects on addressing fire and fire restoration. And those projects are really designed to test whether or not the environmental documentation required by NEPA can be done in a more condensed format rather than the hundreds of pages that are now typical. And
so
those projects are on the ground.
Cut through the red tape, in other words.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you mentioned prevent forest fires. I thought that there was a lot of scientists saying, you know, hey, you know, forest fires, particularly in the back country, these are natural. You just have to let them happen, part of the cycle.
Well, I think certainly that what we call wildland fire use, which is the fires you're mentioning, are very important for ecosystem health. But the condition of our forests and rangelands is so badly now that we can't risk fire. I think if you look back to what happened on National Park Service land a couple of years ago when they tried a prescribed fire project and it got out of hand and many people lost their homes in Los Alamos, tells the story in a vivid way. What we're trying to do is get the lands back to their health, which is their historic fire regimes, so that we can reintroduce fire. I think a second thing to think about is when fire played a natural role in our landscape, we were much less populated. Fire will be an important tool, but it cannot be the only tool, given the number of people now living in the wildland-urban interface and their susceptibility to asthma and other health problems that extensive wildland fire burning would bring about.
Under this proposal, how much timber could loggers remove? And again, I think the question that most people have is, you know, is clear cutting involved here, or selective cutting, or what's involved?
I think what we're talking about is thinning the forest, and I guess at this point I'd like to make the distinction between the Forest Service and the Department of Interior. Here we have the Park Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, the Bureau of Land Management, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, each of which have lands that have to be addressed for fire and healthy restoration. At the Bureau of Land Management, for example, some 75% of our lands do not contain commercial timber. So logging really doesn't factor into it in the program, either here or at the Forest Service. I mean, the idea behind it is to thin the land to get it back to a condition where it can resist fire and the natural ecological functions can once again take place. We're looking at thinning out overly dense forests. Forests right now, the ponderosa pine, are 15 times more dense than they were in the past. So I think when you're talking about Forest Service lands, yes, thinning and logging will take place, but this is not a grand subterfuge to do any kind of logging for commercial purposes. This is designed to restore the health of the lands. That's the focus of the program.
As you know, I'm sure your critics disagree with you. They say it is precisely a subterfuge to boost the timber industry.
Well, I think if you look at the facts right now, you look at the timber industry, one of the first questions would be, what timber industry are we trying to boost? Many of these states no longer have a viable timber industry. We're very challenged in some states to find mills capable of accepting thinned products because the government does not have enough money in its budget to conduct the thinning on its own. We need the public-private partnership. We need people to come in and help us thin, and that is particularly acute on Bureau of Land Management lands where we're addressing species that right now have no commercial value, juniper, and tamarisk and things like that have no value currently. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we're looking at is how to have that play into our efforts to support renewable energy. And by that, I mean the biomass energy. And so those are some of the challenges we're facing is trying to find a way to make this a public-private partnership and a collaborative effort to bring these lands back to health.
Well, again, critics have said that the thinning that you're talking about and, you know, clearing out the brush, and that's important, but that you've given away logging rights as an incentive to the timber companies to go in there and do that.
No, I think that is a mischaracterization of the stewardship contracting authority that we received from Congress this year. This authority is very important, and it builds upon collaboration that is contained in the National Fire Plan. No projects that would utilize the stewardship contracting authority would be selected unless they come out of a collaborative process with all community members involved in selecting those projects. And those projects would not be giving the forest or the rangelands over to commercial interests. They would be continued to be managed by the land managers. They would have to comply with all environmental laws, including the National Environmental Policy Act, which calls for a great deal of public participation. So this would be open to everyone and would be out in the public for public inspection. So I don't think, again, that this is a giveaway to any industry. It is a common sense proposal to address a serious land health problem on our public lands. I think the president has made it pretty clear that doing nothing is not an option.
Rebecca Watson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Rebecca Watson, Assistant Secretary for Land and Mineral Management in the Department of the Interior, and she was with us from her office here in Washington, D.C. And later in the program, we'll be joined by a spokesman for the Wilderness Society to get another point of view on these questions. But joining us now here in Studio 3A is John McClain, author of Fire and Ashes on the Front Lines of American Wildlife and Fire on the Mountain. Good of you to be with us.
Nice to be here, Neil.
The president's initiative is pretty controversial in the environmental community.
It is indeed. Ms. Watson is correct in speaking for the BLM and for the Department of Interior. The most controversial part, however, regards the heavy timber that is represented by the Forest Service. The controversy surrounds the increased logging that's being proposed, or the reintroduction of logging, actually, into some of the national forests. The logging industry is a shadow of what it was. It's down to about 20% of what it was in the 70s at its heyday. there are many, many more people who are living in the wildland urban interface. There is a fuels buildup. There is a call by the Westerners for some kind of active management of these lands, which are causing severe catastrophic fires in numbers that we just haven't seen.
Mm-hmm.
You can look back to 1910, which was a catastrophic fire, 3.5 million acres, no fewer than 85 people dead, but that really was the exception. Last year, you had the biggest fires in the history of Oregon, Arizona, and Colorado, so something's deeply wrong. There is no silver bullet here.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the Healthy Forest Initiatives is 60% of what the Bush administration says it is, it's decades away from solving the problem.
There's a paragraph in your book, Fire and Ashes, on the front lines of American wildfire I wanted to read here. Environmental groups, you write, blame the Forest Service for helping create the situation by decades of fire suppression and support for destructive logging practices. The Forest Service blames the environmental groups for using scare tactics and legal obstacles to block efforts to implement solutions. Scientists say there are no easy solutions and no body of research shows a clear path to follow. Environmentalists say this means we should proceed slowly. The Forest Service says that action, thinning, prescribed fire logging is necessary now. So given you hate to use the word loggerhead, but what do you do?
I think that you recognize that you're in an experimental stage. There's a tremendous amount of attention being given this at the present moment. No one is thinking of going back to the kind of destructive logging practices that occurred in the 60s and 70s and 80s. There isn't the logging industry to do that in the first place. The amount of public attention would stop that in its tracks. I think you have to try, though, and I think that that's what the Forest Service is saying, and to their credit, you know, some of the environmentalists. And I think you have to give the Forest Service and even the Bush administration in this case, although I think that their motives are a little suspect, some leeway to work with this. The number of laws that are out there to protect the environment and to allow for public participation form a long, long laundry list. And writing some rules to streamline those does not remove the laws from the books. NEPA's still there. The Endangered Species Act is still there. These laws are still in place and they're still enforceable. But I think we have to recognize that nobody's got the answer on this one.
Mm.
And that probably what we'll wind up is many different answers. In many different places. The kind of local conditions will dominate this thing. And what you do in one place is not necessarily appropriate somewhere else. So I think that at least initially, there has to be some leeway.
Our phone number again, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Let's go to Karen, who joins us from Jamul in California.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to weigh in. I guess I'm actually on the side of the Forest Service on this one, considering the last comments, although I consider myself to be an environmentalist. But way back in 1969, in an ecology class in college, I wrote a paper about how fire suppression had contributed to devastating forest fires. And there was a scientist who, way back in the 30s, had suggested thinning and prescribed burns to help solve this problem. And in that reference magazine, it was so controversial back in the 30s that there was an editorial at the beginning of the article saying that because this guy is so well-respected, we're going to print this article, but we completely disagree with him.
Hmm.
And if we had started following his ideas in the 30s, or even followed some of the ideas that were being proposed there in the late 60s, we wouldn't be in this mess today. We would have started thinning. We would have started controlled burns. Here in the San Diego area, because it's been so foggy lately, they can have a controlled burn today safely.
Hmm.
And I'm sure that people who live in the area are not happy because of the air pollution from the smoke in the air. But I live in the Chaparral, which is extremely fire-prone.
Karen, can you hold on for us?
Sure.
We're going to have to go to a break now. We'll continue after we come back, okay?
Sure.
800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about what can be done to manage our forests and live with fire. If you live near the woods, what are you doing to protect your home? If you've been into the wildlands, have you seen any areas prone to fires or recovering from one? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest here in Studio 3A is John McClain, author of Fire and Ashes on the Front Lines of American Wildfire. And before we went to the break, Karen was with us from Jumul, California. And you were saying, Karen, you now live in the chaparral. That's brush country, very vulnerable to fire.
It is. In fact, I'm quite worried because I live on a piece of property that this year has not been mowed as it has been in the past. And I'm just a tenant, so I don't really have anything to do about the several acres that were taken care of before. And I don't know what to do other than the fact that I have written to the owner. But I'm scared when this fog goes away in a couple days and the temperature starts going up into the 90s and into the 100s in July and August. It's a tinderbox out here.
John McClain, I was wondering if you had any comments about her remarks.
Well, I think her first remark is a wonderful one, that she seems to find things to support with the Forest Service and considers herself an environmentalist. I hope you find some fora to speak out on that subject, because that's a very good point of view to take. The Forest Service is an agency that has lost its way and is struggling to find itself. And it can use all the support it can get. Chaparral is real dangerous stuff. And the brush programs, the brush treatment programs in California, again, that's an area of great controversy as to whether there should be treatments, whether there should be burning. Back in the old days, when they first started grazing that land, the last guy out at the end of the season lit a match or a torch and burned it off, and they came back the next season. They had green pasture for sheep. That is no longer the case, or if it is the case, you can get arrested for it. There have been brush burning programs instituted that have been severely curtailed because of environmental challenges. Chaparral is at times almost impossible to burn, and at other times it's like gasoline. And it is not an easy thing to deal with. I think that her fears are well-founded, and that something probably should be done to the area she's talking about.
Well, Karen, good luck to you.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Let's go now to Cannoli, and Cannoli's with us from Berkeley, California.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I lived for a number of decades in Forks of Salmon, California, which is a town completely surrounded by National Forest in Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived through three forest fires of 30,000 acres plus and was evacuated twice and fought in all those fires. And over the decades, we monitored the fires in that area and logging sales in that area. And what really fed those fires to a large extent were, in fact, they were built up in brush in different places. And a lot of that really actually were logging sales. What we're looking at right now is that the logging sales that are being sold under categorical exclusion in these other accelerated programs in that area are actually old-growth sales and commercial timber sales that are way far away from any populated areas. And old-growth itself is not a major problem in forest fires. It's the fuel underneath that leads the fires up into the crown. So what we're seeing is that in spite of the fact that I think a lot of the agency people, like the woman that you had on first,
mm-hmm.
are looking at and designing meaningful programs for fuel removal, the way a lot of these laws and exemptions are being actually used on the ground is to promote commercial logging sales.
Yeah. And John McClain, you write in your book about you have personal experience with this. In addition to living in Washington, you also have a cabin out in Montana,
right.
And surrounded by large trees and increasingly by smaller trees.
We've had a buildup there near my cabin since 1910. We have gigantic western larch, 400 and 500 years old. And in recent years, it's become a very dense and dangerous forest. Probably if you had a fire start there, because it's a high-value recreational area that's near a ranger station, you'd have people on it quickly. But there could be a devastating fire. So the Forest Service inaugurated a program to have some thinning and some prescribed burning. And they first did a little demonstration project on the other side of the road, and the thinning amounted to logging, and the burning got away from them at one point, and they had to stop it. And it was a public relations nightmare for several months, and people would stop by the ranger station and scream at the rangers. It's 3 years into that now, and the place is beautiful. The medium-sized larch, 100, 150 years old, have room to grow. You can see them for the first time. Wildlife use the area. And they had a terrible time trying to do it right around my cabin. There were initially some bureaucratic stumbling. They didn't get the bids out on time 1 year. The next year they got them out on time and nobody bid because it's not commercial. Finally, this last year, they did it by trading the job of doing that thinning for commercial timber somewhere else, presumably, perhaps even in the deep woods. I don't know. There are so few loggers now that they didn't get a very good one. And he left a lot of logs. He left a lot of standing timber. Anything that was leaning again close to the cabin or across a power line got left. So I had some smoke jumper friends of mine come out, and we cleared out 10 trees or so. It's going to take us 2 or 3 years, us being myself and the Forest Service and other cabin owners in there, to clean it up. And then it's going to be really terrific. It's going to be beautiful. I think that the point the gentleman from California was making was that he suspects that the subterfuge that you talked about at the beginning of the program, that this is just an excuse to get timber companies into the backcountry where they'll take out old-growth timber and they'll never do anything worthwhile. Let me make a couple of points. If that's the case, there are people like him watching, and they should document that. And if that's what they're doing, by all means, blow the whistle on them. Secondly, this is not a commercial operation. It doesn't pay for itself, thinning mechanically. It's very expensive to do. The price of timber now is catastrophically low. The loss of 80% of the timber or the logging industry isn't just because they've been denied the ability to log in the national forest. It's also because the price of timber has gone way down. Despite what you might think, there is a glut of timber, and prices are very, very low indeed. I think in the long run, denying loggers a right to exist and to use public lands to log can have some unintended catastrophic consequences that you're seeing already. Private companies log heavily on their own lands now. These are lands that we've always considered kind of part of the public domain. It was part of the land giveaway when they put out railroads. Every other square mile went to the railroad company, and those lands are still in private hands. When they get through logging now, they sell off some of that land to private people for recreational purposes. If you log a section, it comes back. If you sell it off into private hands, it's gone forever from the public domain. And I think in about 20 years, some of the people who are now trying to kill the logging industry are going to look back at today and wish that they hadn't done this.
Joining us now from his office in Washington is Michael Francis, director of the National Forest Program at the Wilderness Society. Good of you to be with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Is there anything in the President's Healthy Forest Initiative that you like?
No. Essentially, you know, we know what to do, and you've already had conversations about protecting people's homes and their communities, and that's focusing in close to communities to do the thinning project that need to be done in there. The President's Healthy Forest Initiative doesn't do that. It has more to go to what John just said about watching the Forest Service, having somebody watching the Forest Service. It goes to taking away the ability of somebody to watch the Forest Service by eliminating administrative appeals and trying to narrow the opening of the courthouse door in case there are problems with projects. And while a lot of projects can be done with collaboration, there are projects which could get pushed forward without any safeguards that will be bad. I mean, as I said, the science is there. We know what we need to do as far as protecting people's homes and their communities, that we need to go into these, do the thinning in and around these communities. If you look at it, the just simple math, I'll do a simple math problem. There's a roughly a half mile, a zone a half mile around communities of the 9,000 communities in the Federal Register, 11 million acres. Of and that needs to be treated in order to protect these people's homes
and that,
in the community.
That, by treated, you mean thinned?
Thinned, need to be thinned. At $1,500 an acre, which is about the average cost for mechanical treatments, that's about $18 billion. In fiscal year 2003, the Congress appropriated $397 million. They looked like they might appropriate $398 million for the next fiscal year. So there's very little money to go after a very big problem and to protect people's homes from burning down. So we need to concentrate that kind of limited resources inside the communities to protect these communities, their homes, first before we start doing things that are more experimental and more less likely to protect people's homes when they're located miles from a community.
What about the idea of, if you're going to have people who are going to do that thinning, they got to have some sort of incentive to do it?
Well, there's the money that's in the budget. As I said, there's only $400 million to do it. I mean, if you're going to say we're going to trade big trees, as John was talking about, those western larch, if you're going to trade those western larch to thin out the ponderosa, or thin out the lodgepole pine underneath those ponderosa, underneath those larch, then you're losing the cover that you need for creating shaded fuel breaks and shit in defensive zones around these communities. The fallacy with the stewardship end result contracting is that you're trading big trees to pay for taking out little trees. And that, the scientists say, is not what you want to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is we have to appropriate money. We have to prioritize those appropriations in a time to protect people's home. And if I'm a homeowner in the West, a project 30 miles from my home or 30 miles from my community is not going to protect my house from burning down if there's a wildland fire. It's what's done in close to my home and what's done in close to the community that allows the firefighters to be able to defend the community in my home. You know, that 11 million acre figure I'm talking about, when you look at the land ownership on that 11 million acres, 85% of that is not in federal ownership. It's in state, private, and tribal ownership. And these lands need to be treated as well as the federal lands. And unless those resources are there to treat them, all the money you spend on the federal lands still will not be as effective as if we come up with a comprehensive program and stop the inside the beltway political wrangling that is going on that is preventing work from being done for protecting people's homes and their communities.
Well, Michael Francis, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Francis is director of the National Forest Program at the Wilderness Society. He was with us from his office here in Washington. And let's get back to the phones. Carl is on the line with us from Sandy, Utah.
Yes, I live not far from the Wasatch National Forest, and I agree with the comment that was made in terms of thinning around the homes. One of the disadvantages that I see to thinning in large areas is that it requires a lot of road building, and I'm concerned about the environmental impact of a lot of road building.
And
it seems to me we could take a thinning approach around the homes and prescribe burns in the other areas.
And they just announced regulations on road building in forests just the other day, and that's going to be controversial as well. John McClain, aren't also, if you're talking about this red zone, this interface area, aren't homeowners responsible for their own protection?
Yeah, that's what I was missing in that set of remarks. Homeowners are often, it's a mosaic. Some are good, some are bad, some are indifferent. But if you drive around in the West now and you look at some of the way these, especially the recent developments have gone up on the Front Range in Colorado, for example, down around Durango, where the Missionary Fire burned last year, it's totally irresponsible. I mean, it isn't just a little bit. There'll be a green hillside, solid fuel, much too thick, you know, the kind of place that if you had the money, you'd like to thin it out a little bit. And you'll see chimneys poking out of this green forest. That's where the Missionary Fire burned last year, and many, many homes were incinerated by that. Firefighters are expected to fight hard to save those homes. We as fellow insurance payers are expected to pay the rates that go into insuring those places. Part of the National Forest Plan of 2000, which kind of has bridges the Clinton and Bush administrations, and maybe we can get for a moment away from the political debate, put a lot of money into FireWise, talking to homeowners, trying to get them to do the minimum things to make their homes fire resistant.
Mm-hmm.
Insurance companies are starting to wake up to this.
Carl, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's go to Roy, who's with us from Esther, Alaska.
Hi, Neil. I think the last caller kind of hit on what I'm going to ask about, and I can take the answer off the air. as a homeowner, I've done my share of thinning around our property. I'm willing to pay some sort of insurance to, you know, if I'm in a fire zone or it's dictated that I have to pay a higher insurance premium, I'm willing to do that. I live up on a hill probably 2,000 feet above flooding area, but I pay flood insurance for my home, you know, and, which is fine. I'm willing to do that. And I guess I'd like to hear some of the thoughts on what type of insurance the insurance companies might come up. We're moving into these areas, you know, obviously that are high fire zones, high fire dangers. We know this. I'm willing as a homeowner to pay some type of premium as long as the insurance company comes out and takes a look at my property and says, yeah, he's done the necessary fire protection and we'll give him, you know, something back. Or, you know, I'd just like to hear the viewpoints in that area.
Okay, Roy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
John?
That sort of thing is starting. Some insurance companies are taking account of this, at least on the punishing side. But if you haven't done the kind of minimal things that you say that you've done, and God bless you for doing them, that you will be denied insurance. I mean, that's one way to get people's attention. There are a few builders now who are advertising that we've already done the things to this house and to the area around it that should be done, so when you buy it, you won't have to do them. Once the commercial value of that is realized, I think that situation will change. But the situation now is really very spotty and very bad.
We have an email question. We just have a minute to wind up with you. But this from Brian. Aren't forest fires just like tornadoes and hurricanes and earthquakes? If you build in that area, you suffer the threats of the topography. It's not the fire that's bad. You should just know that if you live there, there's this risk.
You can avoid much of the risk where you can't with a tornado. You can put a metal roof on. You can construct a fuel-free zone 200 feet to a third of a mile around your house. You can move propane tanks, wood piles, and other things, not have a wooden deck. There are many, many things you can do mm-hmm. That give you a much higher chance. Of the homes that burned in Los Alamos in 2000, it's estimated about 90% of those could have been saved if the homeowners had taken basic precautions.
John McLean, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
John McLean is the author of Fire and Ashes, On the Front Lines of American Wildfire, and another book, Fire on the Mountain. He was with us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, we're going to give you two takes on Hillary Clinton's new book, Living History. And for those of you who heard, for those of you who were with us yesterday, you'll know that we put together a list of classic children's literature as suggested by you, our listeners. Mr. Clever, though, forgot to mention where you can find that list. It is at npr.org/program/TOTN, npr.org/program/TOTN, so you can find that list there. We'll be back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.